If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
What happens when the one person who knows the truth decides not to say a damn thing? That's where we are now in the Brian Koberger case. The plea deal is done, the cameras are off, and what's left behind isn't closure. It's a gaping silence. The guy confessed without really confessing. He mumbled a guilty plea, said nothing more than yes, no, I understand, guilty, and walked out of court with a life in prison and the one thing he seems to value most, control. No questions, no answers, no messy trial where the full truth risks spilling out. And for the families, for the public, for anyone trying to make sense of how a 28-year-old criminology PhD student turned into a mass murderer, that silence cuts deep. In this episode, I'm joined by investigative journalist and author Howard Bloom, who's followed the case from the start, and by Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent and behavioral expert. We're talking about what got lost when Koberger took the plea and what might still be hiding in the shadows of this case. We're asking the questions the courtroom never did. Why now? Why plead out just as the state ramps up its prep for trial? Did Koberger do it to protect himself or to shield his parents from ever taking the stand? And did prosecutors hold back the why? Not because they didn't have it, but because they knew they'd never get it from him. We also dig into the broader consequences here. How plea deals in cases like this can sidestep justice under the guise of efficiency. How families might be learning about decisions after the defendant's parents do. And how disturbingly Koberger may now get exactly what he wanted. A lifetime audience of psychologists, profilers, probably a lifetime movie, and curious minds dissecting his story while he plays puppeteer from a prison cell. So the real question is, when justice skips the explanation, who fills in the blanks? And how much damage does that do? Let's get into it. I'm wondering, as more the information comes in, that the gag order has been lifted, and yes, I mean, in theory, would he have killed again? Very likely. Do you think there's going to be evidence that's going to come out that there's other 11, 12 King Road houses out there, essentially, that maybe he was surveilling? Maybe this wasn't the only house that he was sitting outside of late at night, now that we're learning about that, looking in the window of Maddie Mogan. I'm wondering if there's going to be others that are now going to be kind of shocked to think, well, Koberger was also looking at you, too. It just happened to be 1112 King Road. And also, again, two questions. Why settle on this one specifically? Was it just opportunity at the right moment and the right time?
Well, you know, you raise an interesting point. When I was working with Dateline on the special they did, and again, I say working, I had the smallest tangential role, but they found on Koberger's phone photographs of other women, undergraduates at Washington State and also Idaho, University of Idaho. Was he collecting women photographs just for the heck of it, or was he looking for potential targets, his next Maddie? I think one of these women might have been another victim. And if Now, if these photographs become revealed, if you can find him being in the vicinity of those, their houses, their dorms, if you can find him stalking them on social media, you can build the case that he would have been able to strike again, and these were his targets.
I mean, a lot of people are wondering, you know, was this just his first time being in a situation like this? And maybe it was in terms of murder, but what we've learned earlier, obviously there was the issue with his cell phone and the dad and him, Hoberger, trying to sell it at the mall kiosk and the dad calling him in for that. But in a new publication, the James Patterson book that has just come out, there's also allegations that he had been stealing from friends of family, that he had gone to a childhood friend's home, and that he was eventually confronted by the mother, who had noticed that things had been missing out of the house, expensive items. This is the time that he was in with his heroin addiction, getting items to sell for money. It seems, I mean, if that is true, Koberger had a little experience being evasive, getting in and out of houses and taking things, going unnoticed. Have you been surprised by that?
No, I mean, it fits the pattern during his heroin junkie years. Uh-huh. I mean, he was a thief. He was doing anything he can to be able to get the drug. What is more interesting to me is he found the strength, the will, the conviction to kick heroin. He was trying to turn his life around, and yet ultimately he couldn't.
Was this exchanging, you know, one addiction for another, essentially trying to find that high? Because obviously something was very missing for him. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on what was the drive over here off of drugs over to, I guess, homicidal fantasies or putting all of his negative emotions and rage against women in this direction. Is it just one addiction for another?
Well, it's an interim step.
Yeah.
In the middle of this step, after giving up drugs, he tried to become a criminal psychologist. He wanted to become a professor. He tried to aspire to a life where he would integrate himself into normal middle-class life, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a person of respect who was respected. And yet he couldn't. He tried to meet people at the pool party. He couldn't interact with them ultimately. He just couldn't make that leap. And ultimately, you know, biology is destiny. He had to become what he felt he was intrinsically destined to become, and that was a monster. Becoming a student of criminal justice, that fueled his fantasies, and finally, it got to the point where he had to take action.
In your recent airmail piece, you were alluding to the missteps by law enforcement early on in this case, and some of those perplexing aspects remaining unresolved. With officials that are now free to speak, we've been seeing them speaking somewhat. What sort of investigative missteps or challenges are you most interested in clarifying from early on? You were one of the first on the ground there, really looking into this, kind of getting a fresh perspective before many others did. Did any newly released details hint at things that police might have done differently during the investigation, or pieces that now are being revealed that may be stronger than they initially thought they were?
Well, early on in the case, Chief Fry was running the investigation, who quickly gave up the job as soon as Koberger was caught. He said there was nothing for people to fear. The students at the University of Idaho didn't have to worry. This was a targeted crime. And that's not true. That Koberger was still on the loose, and he might well have become a serial killer. Other aspects of the case, the FBI's involvement, the way they, I believe, broke laws to access to the genetic inventory databases when they first became involved in the case, that's always been murky. Ann Taylor said she never got a satisfactory answer. I think the FBI was involved way before the December 19th that they said was their official date when they passed on the tip to Moscow. I'd like that to become clear. I'd like to know how and when they first were on to him and when they first started following him and how active they were in Pennsylvania.
Let's talk about that, your belief that they broke laws. Are you referring to the IgG, the data that was retrieved from those databases versus obviously CODIS didn't have anything in it. Was that the law breaking you're referring to?
Well, yes, and it's not alleged. It came out in the court in motions that the FBI admitted that they accessed databases that they were prohibited from accessing. Some companies like 23andMe do not allow law enforcement to go into their files. And yet the FBI, in their zeal to catch a killer, did that. If they hadn't done that, who knows what would have happened? Koberger still might be on the loose. It was that tip, as they called it, that allowed the Idaho task force to find the car, to make sense of the surveillance videos, and to do the cell phone triangulation.
Was it breaking a law or breaking more of a terms of service? In because I don't know that there's actually there's protocol that says with the FBI, we don't do this, but there's no law, from my understanding, that says we don't do this.
Well, terms of service is a legal term, and I'm certainly not a lawyer. But when you sign an agreement and you assign this agreement with the knowledge that law enforcement can't look at what you're putting into that database, and when they do, that seems to me a violation of the law. Again, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and that could be debated. And lawyers can debate everything, but to me, that's how it seems.
Robin?
That's a layman.
Yeah, it's a great point, and I loved when you brought that up in the book as well, Howard, because you know I've been so part of it, investigations for many years that when I was really thinking hard, it's like, all right, here I am. I'm a case agent working this case. Because all you're always trying to do, and this is what it sounds like they did, is how can I work within the law and realize and kind of understand a difference, as you're alluding to a little bit, the difference between law and policy. Is it a policy of the company that we're breaking or a law that we're breaking? And when I was always trying to work, and this might be the case, that's why it'll be interesting to see during the big reveals that are coming about, because I'd like to know it too. Did they have an inside source, a confidence human source inside the genetic companies that voluntarily gave them, when sensitized to their needs, the information, or did they compel them? Because there's always that fine gray line that the legal people in the office are going to go down. It's like, are you breaking a law, or do you have a confidence human source voluntarily providing information that they weren't tasked to give? My guess is that they were most likely having a case agent and the attorneys in the office riding that gray line and justifying their actions because they thought it was a righteous cause.
Or, as you point out, did they have a human source who called them and gave them a tip on Koberger, who might have been a member of the family? That's another interesting mystery that will come out. Did someone in the family call the FBI and that push them forward to cross this gray line on the genetic inventory information?
Yeah, that's what I'm all in on. It's there's always confidence human sources that are given the tips, given the information that kind of compel investigators to go down one road or another. So I'm leaning on that one as well, Howard.
A mass murderer, a surprise guilty plea, no trial, and no why. The thing about silence is that it's not neutral. It creates a vacuum, and someone's always going to fill it. In Koberger's case, it means speculation takes center stage, rumors grow legs, theories multiply, and all the while, the one person who could connect the final dots is sitting in a cell, exactly where he wants to be, watched, analyzed, and still untouchable. What Howard pointed out, and Robin echoed, is that Koberger may have orchestrated this entire final act as carefully as he planned the murders themselves. The plea spared his life, sure. And more than that, it froze the narrative. No cross-examination, no emotional testimony, no courtroom humiliation, just a quiet pivot from accused to inmate with the spotlight left flickering just enough to keep us looking. Maybe that was the play all along. What's still bothering a lot of people, including us, is how uneven this whole thing felt. The victim's family's blindsided. Koberger's family allegedly in the loop early. A DA who stayed silent even when the public needed clarity. It raises questions not just about what was said, but who gets to hear it and when. Robin brought up something critical. Escalation. This wasn't random. This is part of a larger trajectory. one that began long before Moscow and, if not interrupted, may have continued beyond it. The knife, the mask, the failed attempts at fitting in, all of it suggests Koberger didn't just snap. He curated a persona. He laid groundwork, and he likely had the next chapter in mind. But that chapter's been ripped from public view. No trial means no testimony, no real motive, just legal closure and psychological leftovers. And while we can respect the DA's decision not to gamble with the death penalty, we're also allowed to admit something here feels unfinished. Because it is. Now, we're left with this. A case where justice was served, technically, but explanation was sacrificed. And the haunting part? That might be exactly what Brian Koberger wanted. Tell me what you think in the comments section on our YouTube channel. If you're not there already, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find us there. If you're listening on the podcast platforms, please press subscribe there so you don't miss any of our investigations, our content, and reporting. Wherever you are, please press subscribe so you don't miss any of that. We do greatly appreciate your support there. Thanks to Howard Bloom for his timeless pursuit of truth in this case and to Robin Drake for continuing to remind us that understanding the why is never just about the killer. It's about what we as a society do next. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.